Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, September the 5th, 1995. And in the fireside room this evening, our speaker is Jerry Peterson. And he will be speaking on The Way of Jesus, A Personal Journey to Active Nonviolence. Let's listen in on Jerry Peterson.
My name is Jerry Peterson, who will be teaching this course. And the course is called Nonviolence, The Way of Jesus, the Way of Nonviolence, viewing active nonviolence not as an option, but as essential to the Christian life. Tell you the truth, I was trying to figure out how do I introduce this subject. And I want to put you at ease at first that there are no experts in this field. There's a story about St. Francis of Assisi that he went into the village of Gubbio because they had a problem. There was a fierce wolf that kept coming into town and biting and causing a lot of trouble with the children and the adults. And they asked Francis if he'd come and help because he was good with animals. And he got the village to negotiate a sort of an agreement with the fierce wolf that if they fed him every day, they'd take some food and take it out the edge of town and leave it for him, that the wolf would no longer come in to the village and, you know, play havoc with the people. And it worked. Paki Beni is a Franciscan nonviolent group that tries to train people in the transforming power of nonviolence. And they approach this subject with the idea that all of us have something of a wolf in us, and the untamed wolf that's violent. It's in the dark, it's in the shadow of our lives, you know, and we all have to work at transforming that fierce wolf within ourselves, and then hopefully begin transforming it in the whole world. And I have to acknowledge that that wolf was within me. Nonviolence does not come naturally to me. I have to work at it. And maybe you do too. So don't be afraid to, my real hope is that some of you in the course of this week, if you attend all of them or any one of them, that you might take a step forward in the whole practice of nonviolence in your own life. Let me ask you a question. How many of you would call yourself pacifists? A couple? Three? How many would you call yourself a nonviolent person? Most of us would. Most people say, hey, I'm for peace, I want peace. But saying it and actually living it and making it, you know, exist around you is kind of another matter. How many of you, before you were 16 or 17, had heard of pacifism or the practice of nonviolence? I must confess, I didn't. I was 16 before I think I ever heard the subject. And it only happened because that's when the Second World War broke out. And then there was some discussion. But most people have had no experience, and very little training or education or practice in the practice of nonviolence. And, I find that very strange now. I've asked people all over, you know, and I suppose 75% of the time, Lutheran people, because that's my realm, that, you know, how much have you heard? How much training have you had? How much education in the way of nonviolence? And most of them, doesn't happen at all. In 1941, right after Pearl Harbor, I remember, at that time I was, what, 15? I think 16? And I remember some discussion that there were some conscientious objectors Now, that's the first time I've ever heard of a CO. And the only thing I heard about them at that time was they were cowards. Mm-hmm. They were cowards, or they would have been right in there, you know, to defend all the wonderful things that we defend. Then we had a discussion of pacifism or nonviolence, and the only thing I remembered from it was that they confronted me with the question, if somebody attacked your sister, what would you do? Would you defend her? Would you, you know, would you be ready to use violence to stop them? And at that point, I said, you bet. You bet. Today, I'm not sure what I would do. But the image of the macho person required me to do that. And then Pearl Harbor, you know, happened. That was surely an unprovoked attack. It was a terrible thing that happened. By the way, a few of you were present at that time, or you were living at that time. A lot of you were not. Okay. But you know, they didn't obey the rules of war, did they? They attacked us without telling us. And I've always wondered, what are the rules of war, anyway? I mean, war, seems to me, it doesn't have any rules at all. But at least when I thought about it, even after I got in the Marine Corps, I thought, they selected a military objective. I believe only military objectives were what they attacked in that, wasn't it? Now, it was bad. It was infamy, as President Roosevelt said. But later in that same war, the practice of attacking, bombing, killing civilians was a massive thing. The bombing of London, the bombing of Dresden, the bombing of Tokyo. What is it they say? In incendiary bombings killed, was it 1 million people in Tokyo during that war? And then, of course, Hiroshima, and then Nagasaki, civilian populations. And I'm thinking, that thing at Pearl Harbor at least had a very definite military objective. And to say that they didn't follow the rules of war, I'm not sure what the rules of war are.
Well, the Japanese had very different rules of war than what the United States did.
Yes.
There were civilians killed at Pearl Harbor, though.
I'm sure there were. I'm sure.
Quite a few.
And I'm not defending it. Don't mm-hmm. believe me. But it was out of that that I first started becoming aware that maybe there is a different way than the way of violence. Let me just read a couple of things, because what concerns me is that so few people in our society have ever seriously considered the way of nonviolence. I have asked Lutheran pastors in assembly how often they have ever used in a sermon any information, any encouragement to people to consider what the practice of nonviolence is. Almost none of them. Coleman McCarthy is and has been a very popular, well-known teacher, communicator, and in an interview, these are some of the things he had to say. He says to students, he says, I think you've been cheated in your school. We masterfully educate our kids in the history of war, Caesar's Wars, the Napoleonic Wars, Civil Wars, World War I and II, and even preparation for World War III. We romanticize the militants, George Washington, Robert E. Lee, Davy Crockett, Patton, and all the others. The kids are taught all the battles of Valley Forge, Gettysburg, Lexington. They know nothing about Gandhi, King, Dorothy Day, Tolstoy, Jeanette Rankin, Jesus, St. Francis of Assisi, Jane Addams, Daniel Berrigan. He says, you know, it's okay to believe in force as a way to solve a problem or a conflict. That is the force of justice, the force of love, the force of sharing wealth, the force of organized nonviolent resistance. Fighting with those kinds of effective forces is the essence of pacifism. The force of violence has failed. Well, there's a number of things that I would could quote from him, but the point is, so often we hear that the problem with pacifism is it just won't work. It's not practical, right? As if the way of violence works, or the way of violence is practical. There's nothing practical about it. Just before the Second World War, we had our way of life was radically different than it was after that war and continuing on up into the present. How many people do you think we had in our armed forces, in the Army and the Air Force, prior to the First World War, or Second World War, excuse me?
Half a million?
Yeah. Actually, we had 139,000 in the Army and the Air Force. That was it. Now, that was just before the war broke out in Europe. And then we got really excited. We thought we better start building our forces. And before, in that couple years before we got into it, we really expanded it greatly. We nearly doubled it. During the war, we had 8 million men under arms. I don't think there were any women, were there? Yes, there were flags. I'm sorry, there were women. 8 million. And after the war, we've never come down to anything like pre-war standards. And of course, almost any area you look at, we continued the Second World War into a Cold War. And we've had a war mentality. We've had a war economy. We've had a wartime national budget ever since. We're going to be talking more about a few of those things in a couple days. But they never had a Pentagon before the Second World War. They didn't have a draft. They didn't have peacetime registration. Those are all things introduced since the Second World War. And Coleman and others argue that it's about time we start educating for nonviolence. And if we, you know, it's tough to get into the churches, into the schools. It surely ought to be happening in our churches. Well, what I want to do is spend just a little time tonight reviewing my own personal journey towards active nonviolence. Because I think anybody that gets into nonviolent life and tries to actively engage in it and promote it, it's a journey for them. And it's a journey which, and every time you turn the corner, you have to renew it, you have to grow in it. Let me start with mine. As I said, in 1941, I was 15, 16 that year, and you know, we got into the war. And immediately, we were surrounded, bombarded with all kinds of reasons we ought to be in that. And I was in it, and I still believe if there was ever a justifiable defense of a nation's position, that comes about as good as any war for saying, hey, we were justified in fighting it. I believe it was the last one that had any merit and justifiability. But we were in that one. Except things started to happen. In my junior year, Takahashi, one of my good buddies, suddenly disappeared one day. Japanese student, Long Beach, California. He has disappeared, put in a concentration camp. War does crazy things to people. You start violating your profoundest principles, and you start acting irrationally. The same year, Leroy Brown, who was a black student, president of our class as a senior student, graduated, and like all good students of those days, wanted to volunteer, signed up for the Air Force, or tried to sign up for the Army Air Force. Mm-hmm. He was rejected. Not because he wasn't a sharp student, not because he wasn't physically fit, not because he wasn't a leader. He was president of our school class, he was a straight-A student, but he was black.
Maybe one thing, good thing the war did was reverse that to some extent.
Yeah. Oh, there were more than one, but that's one of them, yeah. In 1943, I graduated, and like all good American boys that could possibly do it, I joined the USS Marine Corps 6 days after I got out of high school. And that was a thing to do, boy, and I was right there. It's amazing, the experiences, though. I remember these all-American, clean-cut American boys going ashore on a Liberty in the Philippines, going into a village of one of our allies and raping women in the little village near there. War does crazy things to people. Things that they wouldn't begin to do in other situations. And then that same year, August the 6th, 1945, I was aboard the battleship USS Missouri in the Marine Corps. And announcement came over the loudspeaker, now hear this. We have news that an unusual bomb of some sort, I think they used the word atomic bomb, I think, although nobody had any idea what that meant, was dropped on the city of Hiroshima and untold damage, probably destroying the city, something to that effect. And we, you know, couldn't hardly believe this. And then a celebration broke out, a little further clarification. Literally, we almost destroyed the city, and probably hundreds of thousands, perhaps, of people were killed, it was said. And on our ship, fellows started shouting and celebrating. Why didn't they drop it on Tokyo and kill 1 million or 10 million, you know? Why don't... No limit to the attitudes. And I was part of the celebration momentarily. And I remember a little later going up to the bow of the ship and reflecting on this, and I thought, what's happened to me? We forgot all about people, all about values in the midst of this. And I cried. I cried as I've never cried before. And it was a time when I determined I'm going to be a peacemaker. And war isn't the way to make peace. I was convinced of that. And I even thought about possibly becoming a pastor, although that seemed like a foreign idea. I'd never given it any thought. Nobody had ever been a pastor for any of my families. But then a couple days later, bomb in Nagasaki. At the time, a lot of fellows thought, because they were told, that's what ended the war. Any honest appraisal of that today, with the release of all the documents available, reveals that the war would have come to an end, maybe not quite as rapidly, but it would have come to an end without an invasion of Japan, without all the terrible loss of life that was contemplated, but for various reasons, largely political reasons, we dropped that bomb. And as of yet, the only nation that's ever dropped one. And then on September 2nd, was that last Saturday? Yeah. The day I was supposed to come up here, and I didn't because we had a celebration going. I was aboard the USS Missouri in the Honor Guard, you know, a PFC Marine boy, 25 feet from the table where MacArthur and Nimitz and Halsey and all those guys signed the surrender ceremony with the Prime Minister of Japan to bring the war officially to a close. And that was a great moment. One of the lasting experiences, besides seeing these big names and all, Russian newsmen and different nationality reporters were assigned different places to take their cameras and so on. They were standing right behind the honor guard there, and they wanted a little better position to grind away their cameras and such, and they kept pushing us aside. We kept saying, hey, get back there, you know. But here, these were these allies of ours, you know, people that was, they helped us win that war and all that. September 2nd. Navy Day in October, our ship had come back through the Panama Canal up to New York. We participated in Navy Day, and already the headlines in the newspapers were the Russians are enemies, you know. And shortly after that, Churchill came out with the Great Iron Curtain speech. Friends have become enemies, and the enemies have become almost friends, and all this by flicking of the wrist. And I began to suspicion that war and militarism is somehow manipulated for all kinds of purposes besides, you know, the announced ones. Well, wasn't but a few years we were in Korea. A few years later, a spy plane was shot down, which we denied. Our president, President Eisenhower, denied that we had any spy planes over Russia. And then they not only produced part of the plane, but they produced the pilot. And were we embarrassed? Because militarism and that whole game makes you liars, makes you deceitful. It twists and make out of you what you're not proud to be. Shortly after that, Eisenhower made that famous statement he made. I tried to look it up and couldn't find it at the moment, but it was General Eisenhower, we all know him, very conservative president, general in the Second World War, but nobody could accuse him of being ultra-liberal. But he made the statement that every dollar that's spent on airplanes or guns or bombs or is directly taking food out of the mouths of the poor, away from education, developing of a more progressive society, and so on. Here was this famous general warning us out of his experience, not only in the wartime, but now as President of the United States for 8 years. This was one of the final things he told us, that militarism has a way of just growing on itself. And then there was Cuba, and almost a confrontation with Russians. Then the 60s came along, and all this time I was committed to peace, peacemaking. I talked about it a little bit, but very frankly, I did very little in the way of actually engaging as a peacemaker. I talked about it, but I really didn't do very much about it. What got me involved was the civil rights movement. And finally, somebody came along, Martin Luther King, that took the theory of nonviolence or pacifism and applied it with a technique or a method of making it work in our social situation here in the United States. Active nonviolence, direct action nonviolence, and literally helped change the whole civil rights race practice here in the United States. Helped bring about the Civil Rights Act of, was it 1964? Terribly important thing. And suddenly I became aware that Jesus said, blessed are the peacemakers. Yeah, they'll see God. He didn't say those people that think peace or kind of have, you know, a general wish that it were so. He said those who are peace livers, peacemakers, people that are actively involved in living out and promoting, developing peace. And for the first time, I began to see it wasn't just war. War is one thing. What time did we start?
6:30.
War is one thing, but now I was seeing peacemaking has to do with all kinds of other social relationships, race relations, and other things. And that the practice of active, direct nonviolence was a means of nonviolently bringing a group of people or bringing society to a more justice-oriented and peace-respectable way of life. And a lot of people learned that. Well, of course, I went to East Africa at that time for 3 years. So I was away from it for a few years. When I left, I remember, just before the election in 1964, let's see, that was between that hawk named Goldwater and a dove named Lyndon Johnson. And one thing we were promised, if you voted for Johnson, we wouldn't get involved in any crazy war any further in Vietnam, right? That's what I remembered from the election period in the summer, because I left in September. And then I started reading from East Africa about this growth in Vietnam and that whole ridiculous thing we got into. Just recently, who was the McNamara? Yeah, who was the Department of Defense Secretary during that war? Is that right in his office?
Yeah.
Yeah, he, you know, made statements like, but we, our policy, we just didn't know that the policy was such a disastrous policy. I don't know how he could have not known it when every one of the students that I had at San Francisco State knew it. And students all over the country and all kinds of young people and all kinds of people who didn't have some stake in the establishment that, you know, that profited from it one way or another. And again, I saw the breakdown of the use of nonviolence often during that wartime, but at least a lot of people started becoming aware that that was a, if there was any war that we shouldn't have been in, that was one of them. And that there had to be a better and another way. Well, it goes on. Skip a number of things. The 70s, I was very active in the farm labor situation in California. And along came another Jesus figure, Cesar Chavez, who helped largely uneducated, very low-class field workers by using the whole system of direct action, nonviolence, brought about radical change in the whole farm industry by refusing to use violence in picketing and pressuring for social change. They achieved amazing things during the late 60s, early 70s. And again, I thought, active nonviolence is a way of bringing about improved social condition. John F. Kennedy said, those who make peaceful revolution, peaceful change, impossible, they make violent revolution or violent change inevitable. And I think there's so much truth to that. Let's see. Then the 70s and 80s, there was the nuclear war scare, developing this great capacity. And for all kinds of reasons, there were occasions to be involved in that. And then right after that, the whole Central American scene. I went down with Witnesses for Peace in Nicaragua and saw that the whole strategy there was, if we could get enough Americans right in the middle of that conflict, one thing that the Contras aren't going to do, because they're not going to hurt Americans. They may try to destroy Nicaraguans, but they're not going to destroy Americans. So Witness for Peace said, let's be a presence, being present nonviolently, but just to be present, to see if we can help somehow resolve this conflict situation. And of course, Nicaraguan didn't want to harm Americans because they were trying to get us to change our policies. That was the 70s and 80s. In the 80s, we saw liberation theology and small-based, Christian-based communities studying how, all over Central America, studying how they could use nonviolent tactics to bring small changes in their village situations, and really did some amazing things. Well, the last incident I want to just refer to is 1990, the Iraqi War. Was that in 1990?
91.
90.
91.
90?
Yeah,
91.
Well,
it was short. It was, must have been 90.
Yeah, I think it was 90.
No,
it was 90.
January 91, right? No, it was 90. Same war. I think you're right. I think it was January 91, yeah, because I retired in 92. It was a year and a half later. That's right. It was. But I remember I was very, I was excited. I was hopeful. For the first time, we faced a possible war situation. And really, for the first time, the churches of America said, wait a minute, there's got to be a better way. And so the Bishops' Conference of the Roman Catholic Church took a very strong position in saying, wait a minute now, let's push for better negotiations, let's try boycott, let's try every other procedure, because the justifiable war theory, which basically they're committed to, as Lutherans are and most of our churches are, said you can't possibly rightly go to war unless you've exhausted all the other alternatives. And they were saying it before the war started. They said that really never happened before. And even the evangelicals took some pretty good action at that time. And the Council of Churches took a very strong position. And of all things, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, which I'm a pastor of, took a strong position, and our bishop communicated this to the Congress and to the president. And I thought, wow, this is one of those times where Christian thought is going to come into play, where the practice of nonviolent and seeking other alternatives, you know, was really going to come forth. I remember Sunday morning, I think it was the second Sunday in January, and it was 91. I shared this with the congregation and asked them to write to Congress, because that week Congress was going to vote, you know, and gave them all this evidence for the best of thinking of much leadership. I think probably 20% of my congregation did that. The truth is, the mass media, the organs of our government, they snowball the rationale, the hysteria, the irrationality of the use of violence to resolve problems. But of course, we had the war, it was very short, and it solved all the problems in Iraq, didn't it? Mm-hmm.
So we can forget about Iraq now. Huh? No, we didn't solve anything in that situation. We didn't establish democracy in Kuwait. It's still the most undemocratic little regime probably in the country, in the world. Iraq is still the same situation it was. Violence doesn't work. It's that simple. Nonviolence, they say, is impractical, but Martin Luther King says, what we demonstrated by the use of nonviolence is that it does work. It does work. And we've now arrived at the point, because of the sophistication of technology and all the things that we have at our fingertips, we've arrived at the point where what was once thought the only realistic thing, that was to be ready to use violence to stop violence, doesn't work. And the only realistic thing is this crazy notion of nonviolence. I believe it's right. And that's kind of my journey. And I've very few successes to point to personally, but I witness that there are all kinds of successes in the practice of nonviolence, whether it was in the great fields of California or the whole social change situation in India or civil rights movement or what. Nonviolence is based on the use of power, but never the negative power of threats, guns, or bombs. Nonviolence is the belief that love or soul force or the Holy Spirit is a greater power than any violence. It is really the simple, profound belief that God is love put into practice. Nonviolence is the active use of power to bring about change. It calls for total involvement and commitment. It is never passive. It requires the most profound spiritual strength and religious convictions. It simply is the belief that this is God's world and God is in charge, and that hate and violence will not win. Now, it seems to me, if there's anything that should be evident to Christians, it's that we need to give the way of nonviolence, of active nonviolence, a real chance. And in the next 4 weeks, or 4 sessions, I hope to show a little better that this really is the way of Jesus. It's not just some option for the Christian life. I don't think it's one of the options. I think it's at the heart, the very center of what being a Christian means. And we'll try to talk a little bit and demonstrate that. Now, having said that, just one more thing I have to add. If I'm absolutely honest, I must confess that there may be an exception to my commitment to nonviolence. It isn't, what would I do if somebody attacked my wife? That's not when the exception comes up. By the way, why do people always bring up that kind of a question on this issue? There's 99 things that precede that question. It's just like, well, do you believe in abortion? Naturally, nobody wants an abortion. But before you start talking about abortion, you need to start talking about what? Family planning and jobs for single women and child care for children and education for kids in school and a dozen things. And then after all those other things, then there's the question, well, what about abortion? And you want to talk about nonviolence. Nonviolence is, it's so many things before the choice of actual responding to a violent situation comes up. Nonviolence is not a passive thing. I don't use the word pacifism. I don't like it because it suggests that nonviolence is too passive. It means kind of weakling. It means sitting back. It means doing nothing. Hey, a commitment to active nonviolence means long before the problem becomes known, you know, to most, you're actively at work creating a situation that will prevent the necessity of any kind of violence. It's outsmarting the situation. It's being, you know, it's doing a thousand things before that final question comes up. What would you do if? That's why tomorrow we're going to talk a little more about what is the nature of violence itself, so that then we can go on the next day and ask, now what was Jesus' specific instructions or guidance about nonviolence? But I have an exception. Today, if I were a peasant living in Guatemala or El Salvador or Nicaragua, and I've spent considerable time in those places, if I were in Haiti, and if I were in I don't know how many other places around the earth, I'm not sure I'd be saying, hey, we need to practice active nonviolence. Or for that matter, if I were a black person living in Los Angeles, or Detroit, or New York, or if I were a male facing the situation that I, as a black male, would have to face, or a black female, what I'd have to face, where the strategy really is build a lot more prisons for us rather than help us get education and jobs. I don't know. Maybe I would say, nonviolence, that's a cop-out, brother. Because you're talking to us, the victims, the oppressed. I really believe the choice is ours, who have some power, who are on the top of the heap, and I don't care what your wealth situation, man, you all look pretty white to me and look pretty well off, you know. We're the oppressor. We may not like the word, we may not accept it, but that's about the reality. We have a choice. I have a choice. I honestly don't know that I can go and tell the oppressed of the earth. Theoretically, I believe it for them. But if I were one of them, and I'd say, wait a minute. Every waking moment of my life, the power of those comes down on me to keep me in my place. I might say, you take your idea of nonviolence, you get old Whitey, and you get those Americans, and you get those Europeans, and the people that are running the show to practice it, and then maybe I'd listen. I don't know. I'd invite some discussion on this. Tomorrow, we're going to give a great deal of attention to this. Just a couple of thoughts. Martin Luther King said, "What is disturbing is not the appalling actions of bad people, it's the appalling silence of good people." Latin American bishops, about the situation that they face in all their countries, the choice is not between the states, the choice is not between the status quo and change. It's rather between violent change and peaceful change. But change there will be. I'm beginning to believe we should ask ourselves not, do you believe in God? But we should ask people, what God do you believe in? At the Reformation, they ask, how can I find a gracious God? And they came to the powerful truth of Scripture in an answer to that. But maybe the same question in our society is to ask, how can we find God in the enemy? Jesus has an answer for both of them, and we'll explore that the next few days. Now, I'd invite some comments, questions, other points of view. I didn't intend this to be so much a lecture, but it's easier if you keep you the guys quiet,
up.
See?
You got wound up.
How was your journey? My guess is, as I started asking in the beginning, everybody is for peace, but how do we work that out? That's the biggie.
I like to think that I've been involved in a few nonviolent movements. I've read For the World is something that concerns me a great deal. I had a son in Uganda. We went to visit him last summer. And I regularly write to the president and to my congressman and encourage a decrease of military spending and more for humanitarian people, which I think will produce peace much more down the line. But I'm just curious, would you have liked to have seen the United States military return to 139,000 in the 1960s? I think every time we put a gun into a policeman's holster, this is sort of a violent approach to things. Are you opposed to all of those kinds of things?
Good question. Yeah. Well, I tell you,
I'd probably settle for two or three or four times 139,000. I'm not sure I'd settle for the kind of military budgets and the massive research and brains and human power that goes into those things. No, I think there's a proper place for our peace forces. But I think that's what they're supposed to be. And unfortunately, the military is getting smarter than most of the rest of us. They have resisted more of the military actions of late. Vietnam, hey, they said, this is crazy. You're giving us instructions that are ridiculous. In the Iraqi war, they were not necessarily pushing for that involvement, and because they know the limitations and the problems. National security surely is not, we haven't gained it by massive expenditures for those efforts, because our security is not from outside, the security is from within, because we have an eroded social base of people and all in our country. And you bring guns, I don't know why we have this free carrying and use of guns. I guess people need to have the possibility of having guns, and I guess if they could have rifles. But I don't believe anybody should be able to have a gun that's not registered. I spent 3 days in Ashland with my brother-in-law, who's a member of the National Rifle Association. And he's a pretty intelligent guy.
Love your enemy. Yeah.
And I you know, I hear all that he has to say, but I want to respect. I grew up a whitey. And I still like to think of the policeman as my friend, my protector. And I still feel that way. Although, having been in Africa for 30 years and having been at a San Francisco State University where I had all kinds of association with students, student, black students and African faculty, black faculty and so on. And he said, if you grow up in the black community, you don't think of them that way. Mm-hmm. And I think, ooh, we've got to change that situation. We can't allow that kind of situation to persist, because the system doesn't work if the policeman isn't a good guy. We have real problems. I don't know. I came back from East Africa after 3 years. I went to England, and I saw police cars. They weren't Volkswagens. What do they drive in England? Austin? Is it Austin? Or they look like Volkswagen. They're painted white and green. And you can see this big policeman crawling out of the thing, and they look like police officers. They had a big Vietnam demonstration when I was there in 67. And there probably were 10,000 students in this, or not 10,000 people, these are students, some of them were students, marching along. And here were these policemen walking alongside, they had guns, they were buddies to the people in the march. I flew to New York City and got out. And the first police car I saw scared the life out of me. It seemed like it was about 40 feet long. It was black. There were two fellows sitting in there with big leather jackets on. There was a gun, a rifle, sticking right there in the front seat. And it looked like a tank. And something's wrong. And I believe a persistent, awakened Christian community committed to active nonviolence could begin creating a situation where police officers would have our respect, and we wouldn't be faced with the kind of situation we have. What do you think?
No, I think so too. We lived in Japan for 6 years, and the police officers were friends of everyone in Japan, and you did not have guns in Japan. I mean, yeah. It was just unheard of. Prohibited, unheard of for people to have guns. But on the other side of it, the Gulf thing happened while we were in Japan, and the United States caught a lot of flack. Those cowboys' gunboat policy and one thing or another. And yet when I went to Singapore, I heard an altogether different story. The people in Singapore remembered what it had been to have been occupied, to have their men shot in the street and their women raped in the homes by the Japanese army. And they said, hey, we are very pleased to think that the big power in the world still sometimes looks out for the little people. Now, I'm not defending how we did it in Iraq. Maybe if we could have put a line of troops along that Kuwait border and said, you don't cross this border or something like that, that would have been a great deal better. But also, you know, the Japanese, I think, are pleased that South Korea was not run by the communists with their military might sitting right across from Japan and so forth. And so I'm not ready to rule out the possibilities where the strength of the United States can be used for peace, military strength.
Mm-hmm. I hope our real strength is in something.
I hope so too.
Other else,
I hope so too.
You know, that is a strength.
No, our strength will not be in our missiles. That's for sure.
Yeah. Other.
What about Amnesty International?
Would you speak up a little?
What about Amnesty International?
Fantastic group. Yes. You acting in that, or have you?
I have been, up to a very limited degree. Mm-hmm.
Bread for the World, I'm very much involved in all. I honestly have not been very participating in, and you just can't get into everything, you know. Boy, I take my hats off, they're doing some math. And absolutely necessary things, too. They've been behind, who's the lawyer that was killed out in Guatemala recently, and the Guatemala, the American woman,
the lawyer
has been campaigning. And amnesty, by exposing those things, brings them to worldwide attention.
I got a little turned off, though, when they came to my state of Nebraska in defense of a man who had been condemned to the electric chair, and they came and picketed, I suppose you'd say, in favor of not killing him. And he's been on death row for years and years. I can't think of his name now. Can you help me with that? I can't remember what his name was. Ote, I think it was.
Harold Ote.
Yeah.
Our time is about up. I just want to say I'm disappointed you people are here. I wanted some people here who were had no sympathy for nonviolence, because I like to convert people. I like to bring them along. You fellows are people are too far advanced, I think. But my guess is you need to be pushed like I need to be pushed. You know, I've stood in a lot of protest lines and committed civil disobedience time after time. And most of the time it didn't change very much, but it did prevent me from being changed. And that's one of my chief reasons for my activism, is at least it'll keep reminding me of where my commitments are, and that if you think it's going to be easy, well, you just got the wrong message. But tomorrow, I didn't mention, I would suggest in the bookstore Religion and Violence by Robert McAfee Brown. It's the best single thing. Now, there's a revision that he just came out with about 5 years ago. This is 15 years, or maybe 20 years now. But it's still so good, there's nothing better at a moderate price. Religion and Violence. And then a much tougher one, The Nonviolent Violent Coming of God by James Douglas, is fantastic. I had to read this and kind of reread it, but it's a biblical study, it's solid stuff, and once you catch the idea of it, it's just fantastic. There's another, Violence Unveiled, and the Sunday when I went to the bookstore, I saw they had two copies. I went in this morning, neither one are there. And I asked, and they didn't know. The person there couldn't tell me what happened to them. Anybody buy those? I suggested those. Those are very expensive, but I've only had a chance to peruse it. It's just recently come out. But basically, it takes the view that human history has been filled with sacred violence, and the religions of all over the world has been the sanctifying force behind the use of violence, sacred violence here. And the time has come where it's now possible.